Hi, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in East Asian Studies. Welcome and thanks for joining us. I recently had the great pleasure of talking with Scott Cook about The Bamboo Texts of Guo Dian, a study and complete translation. This came out with the Cornell East Asia series in 2012. This is an absolutely phenomenal and kind of game-changing scholarly achievement. What it is two volumes, both of which include detailed transcriptions, translations, and really rich commentaries on and introductions to all of the Guo Dian texts. These were texts that on bamboo strips that were recovered from a tomb in Hubei in 1993, and they are just massively fascinating and important and interesting documents for all kinds of reasons. Now, I won't talk too much about it because you'll hear a description of them and of many of the texts that are included within the corpus of, or at least the group of Guo Dian texts in a moment. But I will say that this was an interview I was particularly excited about because having this resource really transforms how we can not just learn about, study, and do research on the history of early China and with early China, it also transforms our teaching about this context and this history. So it's a very exciting volume. It was really a pleasure to talk with Scott about it, and I hope you have a chance to get a copy of the two volumes, take a look at them, use them. They're really, really useful, and they're laid out in a way that really facilitates use in the classroom as well as in research, and I hope you enjoy. We're here today to talk with Scott Cook about his awesome new book, The Bamboo Texts of Guo Dian, A Study and Complete Translation. Scott, thank you so much for making the time to talk with me today, and welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies. I'm really, really delighted to talk with you about this really impressive project. So thank you for making the time.
Well, thank you, Carla. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm looking forward to speaking with you about that.
So could you start us off, as is traditional for the channel, by saying a little bit about yourself and your background, and specifically, what brought you to the study of early China?
I guess it's pretty much the way anybody comes about their career path. It's a combination of both interest and accident. In terms of specifically how I arrived here, I actually started out my college studies as a music major. I took some Chinese in college, but my focus was originally on music, and it wasn't until I was pursuing a master's in music theory that I really got back to the study of Chinese. And it developed, or it continued to cultivate, let's say, an intense interest in the language itself. So at that point, I came back with, taking third year Chinese, classical Chinese, and after getting my master's in music theory, I decided, music really wasn't the route I wanted to go. I really, in some ways, better suited to the study of language than I was to music, and although both have remained intense interests for me throughout my life. So I went to Taiwan for a year and studied intensively at the IUP program there, both modern language and classical, and came back to pursue a PhD in Chinese at that point. So it was kind of a circuitous route for me to get into the study of early China. But early China specifically, I really fell in love with the classical Chinese language. So for me, it wasn't so much the route that some academics have taken, where they have started off with an interest in Chinese philosophy, perhaps, or Chinese religion, having read something in translation that really piqued their interest. For me, it was really the other way around, interest in the language first, and through the language, getting interested in the text, and it's kind of snowballed from there.
So that's really interesting, in part because I know, as somebody who's sort of spends a little bit of time dabbling in trying to learn musical instruments myself, just as a total neophyte, there are a lot of commonalities between studying language and studying music.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and music actually will come up, I think, I hope, later on in our conversation, because one of the texts explicitly talks about the importance of music to education and to human nature later on as we get into the text.
Right.
It's actually really interesting to hear. So the book that we're talking about today is one of these game-changing texts and game-changing resources in a field, and I say that without hyperbole and in complete honesty. It's a massive two-volume study, transcription and translation of the bamboo texts recovered in 1993, I think, from a tomb in the village of Guodian in Hubei province. And this was a tomb that was interred in the Warring States era. This is the kind of book that is, and we'll sort of get to this later, this is it transforms the possibilities of teaching with and about China and of studying with and about China, and I think will for some time. And so congratulations. It's something I'm actually really excited about having the chance to feature on the channel. So given that, well, my pleasure. What brought you to the project in the first place? Can you situate your work on this project within your larger trajectory of research interests?
Sure. Beginning from my first graduate studies in Chinese, I was gravitated toward the Warring States period in the because it's one of the most exciting times in early in Chinese thought, with the period of the 100 schools, each offering competing visions of statecraft, and just trying to, I was very interested in kind of sorting it all out, looking at the connections between different thinkers and trying to figure out in my own way how the intellectual history of the period played itself out. So I've always been interested in a lot of different thinkers and ideas of that period and how they relate to one another. Now, I want to argue with you about the importance of the work insofar as the work that I'm not my own work, but the work that of the Guodian manuscripts themselves, because these really are extremely important for the study of early China, because really nothing like them has been discovered since the 3rd century AD. And so when they came out, really the only authentic archaeologically excavated texts that that are philosophical texts to actually date from the Warring States period. So once they came out, there was a flurry of scholarly activity on them. There's just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of articles coming out in China, not to mention Taiwan and Japan, and also a lot of interest in the West as well. So they're naturally kind of earth-changing in that regard. I just happened to be the only scholar that was crazy enough to try and actually translate the whole damn thing. So that's how, but it was really natural for me to kind of come and focus on these texts, given my overall trajectory of what I was studying.
And how long did that did the entire project of transcribing and translating these texts take for you? This took, and as it should be, it took quite some time. Yeah.
About 13 years.
Yeah.
Pretty much from the time they first came out, it was, it's been ongoing ever since that time. And that's partly due to the enormous complexity of the text itself and all the ambiguities in coming up with an interpretation, but also just because sorting through all the mass of scholarship that's been written on these texts, especially in China.
Now, in the course of talking about also the text in the book, I think we're going to have an opportunity today to talk about some of the aspects of that process that actually make it so extraordinarily different from other processes of textual study for those of us who can even go to a rare books library and look at a Ming text. And I mean, that's not the kind of process that went into transcribing and translating these. And so we'll get into those, I think, really fascinating elements of craft and sort of to see why something like this would take 13 years. And I'm actually amazed that it only took you, frankly, 13 years.
Well.
So that's kind of amazing in and of itself. So let's, in order to give listeners who may not be familiar with the texts themselves, but also with the importance of and the nature of excavated texts for the study of China, let's kind of start with the tomb and then work our way to the fragments and then the texts themselves. So could you start us off by saying a little bit about this? What was the nature of this tomb? Who was the tomb occupant? And what was the context, basically, in which these fragments and these textual elements were found?
Okay, well, the tomb itself is relatively nondescript. It's like many other tombs in China. I mean, the first important thing to know is it's from the region of the state of Chu, which during the Warring States was kind of on the cultural the southern cultural periphery of China and had in many ways its own unique characteristics. The tomb itself, it's a typical, like a rectangular, earth-built, vertical shaft, constructed tomb, which has a sloped rectangular ramp. There are inner and outer coffins, and the outer coffin is divided into three different sections. But the important thing to note in all this is that the construction techniques of the tomb, of the coffin, and, what remains of the vessels, given that the tomb was looted prior to excavation, all indicate that it bears Chu cultural characteristics, which is important in the dating of the tomb because in 278 BC, the state of Qin sacked the capital of Chu, and from that point forward, all the tombs of the area bear Qin characteristics rather than Chu. So we know that the very last possible date of interment is 278 BC. As far as the occupant goes, we only know for sure that he was a male occupant based on some of the walking the staffs that are found in the tomb, along with all the various weapons and things of that nature, and based on the types of vessels that he had and things of that nature, and the construction of the tomb itself, it was probably a member of the mid to lower nobility of the state of Chu. Some have speculated, based on very scant evidence, that he may have been a tutor to the crown prince. Mm-hmm. And this is based primarily on the fact that there was a lacquer ear cup excavated that had on its underside the inscription that read either Dong Gong Zhi Shi or Dong Gong Zhi Bei. So it's either tutor of the Eastern Chamber or simply cup of the Eastern Chamber, an Eastern Chamber referring ostensibly to the residence of the Crown Prince. And then there's debate about whether that last character was standing for Bei or for Shi. And in any case, it's very scant evidence by which to go. We only know that texts were very important for this person because they were they saw fit to accompany them into his afterlife. But other than that, we don't really know a whole lot about the actual status or the actual occupation of the tomb occupant.
Now, you mentioned that this is from the state of Chu. The texts actually were not written in standard Chinese characters, but rather they're written in Chu script. And this actually becomes a really important part of, at least from the perspective of this reader, right? The process of what mm-hmm. it meant to work with and actually create a text, right, out of the fragments. So what's important for us and for listeners to know about the Chu script in order to appreciate the nature of the text and the work that you had and that was involved in your translation, transcription, and study of them?
Okay, well, so the Chu script is one of a number of regional variants, right? It's what we refer to in the Warring States as the script of the six states, because each state had its own regional varying forms of the Chinese script, which wouldn't be standardized until the advent of Imperial China during the Qin and the Han. I guess the most important thing to know is that these scripts had their own orthographic conventions, which is to say, certain characters may be written without the semantic classifier that we would be accustomed to seeing based on later standardized orthography, or certain characters would be used, primarily out of phonetic considerations to represent words that we're not accustomed to seeing them represent. So a lot of words that were used purely as phonetic loans or were used in ways that may have been somewhat standard to a Chu scribe, but that it's difficult for us to recognize. But there's also an awful lot of arbitrariness in terms of what characters were chosen to represent a word, even within the same sentence. A character may be written clearly representing the same word, but written one way in one half of the sentence and a slightly different way in the other half of the sentence. On the other hand, you also have words like sheng, for instance, the sage, which could be used to represent three different words, right? Sage, sound, sheng, or ting, to listen. So you have all these ambiguities in trying to interpret the Chu script, or really any script of that time, that you really don't have with scripts that were written or texts that were transmitted from the Han Dynasty onward, or even Warring States scripts that were kind of reassembled during the Han and converted into standard orthography.
Great. Thank you so much. So this is just the, or not necessarily the first, but one of many, many aspects of interpretation, recombination, and different kinds of work that goes into the final, or that went into the final product of actually compiling a transcription and translation of these texts. And one of these important stages has to do with sorting and arranging the texts. Now, for listeners who aren't familiar with this kind of a set of documents and this kind of excavated text, this was not the case in which you had accessible to yourself and other scholars had accessible to them an obvious set of texts that each even hung together clearly as a coherent text, right? This wasn't a case in which open up the tomb, oh, look, there are whatever, you know, 13, 14, 15 comfortably bound volumes there. Let's take them out and read them. And I mean, even deciding what a text, what constituted an individual text for these documents was its own kind of a challenge and was a really substantial amount of work. And you describe a lot of elements of that process and scholarship around that process in the volumes themselves in a way that's really fascinating. So let's talk about that a little bit. In particular and specifically, what were some of the most challenging and sort of important and notable aspects of sorting and arranging these texts as texts that were part of the process of working on this project? And what do listeners have to know from your perspective to appreciate that kind of work and the magnitude of that kind of work that went into the finished product that we have here today?
Okay, sure. So first of all, when the texts were excavated, they were kind of like let's step back and say that the texts were originally bound, right, in terms of each scroll was bound by tying strings. But of course, these strings had long since disintegrated, and so the text became all jumbled together and internally out of order as well. So you at excavation, you essentially have this whole group of strips that are immersed in water and encased in mud and completely out of order. And so once the texts were cleaned and photographed and preserved, they had to be sorted out. And the first step was to sort them into individual texts. And this was done on the basis of some distinctive features of the scripts, of the strips. So for one, strip length. Another one is strip end shape. Some of them are flat, some of them are beveled. The number of tying notches and the distance between those tying notches. And then finally, the structural and the calligraphic features of the graphs themselves. And so most of this work, the editors of the initial volume that was published in 1998 had already sorted out, I think, more or less satisfactorily in terms of assigning the strips to each individual text. There may be one or two exceptions where strips were assigned incorrectly, but for the most part, the strips were able to be sorted into individual texts based on those different features. The biggest problem involves the internal ordering of the strips, because once you have these texts sorted out, each text has the strips of equivalent length and features internally. So you have to go entirely by context in determining what the order of the strips are, because these strips are not numbered in any way. And in the case of those one or two texts, like the Laozi or the Zi, where you have received and or other excavated counterparts, you have a pretty good basis by which to put the strips back together in the proper order. But with these other texts where you have no means of comparison, you really have to rely on context alone and look at parallelisms, look where the text may or may not be going. So in the initial volume, the editors had done preliminary work on this, and they would have blocks of certain strips that they knew probably read together in this order, but then the next block would be separated physically to indicate that, well, we don't know what the connection is between this block and the next. And so there remained a lot of work to be done on determining what the proper order of the strips might be. And so that's been something a lot of us have been involved with over many years, and really is still ongoing in terms of determining exactly what the proper order of the strips might be. I think most of the problems have been sorted out, but there's still, even to this day, now my translation has finally been published, but I think there's still more work to be done in this regard.
Thank you so much. So once the, let's say a scholar has come to a comfortable, or at least comfortable enough, feeling of what the nature of each text is, or which texts hang together as texts, and the arranging and sorting has been done, or at least has been done to some degree of satisfaction, there remains the practice and the process of transcribing and then interpreting the graphs. So basically transcribing them as texts and then interpreting and reading and translating the texts. And this is, this is what we have so wonderfully after the interpretations that you give us in the introduction of these two volumes, is a series of transcriptions of, translations of, and studies of each one of the texts in this collection. So to get us started in terms of looking at the texts, or some of the texts individually, first let's start with thinking about the processes involved in this project more generally. So in your experience going through all these texts, and spending 13 years on this, were there any particularly gratifying and exciting and or particularly challenging aspects of the transcription and interpretation process for you as you worked through the volume? Or does anything immediately come to your mind?
In terms of my own sort of discoveries and things of that nature, I think that what I was just talking about in terms of the strip order was kind of the most interesting aspect of it for me, in terms of sorting out the puzzles. I mentioned this early on at a conference in China that, came to the study of the text in the sense that I mentioned that when I was young, I used to enjoy playing with puzzles, and now I still do. But now instead of, game puzzles, it's puzzles involving the sorting of strips into a strip order and things like that. And I've kind of been known for that line ever since, because I think it struck a chord with a lot of the scholars there. They can see where I'm coming from with that. So coming to some certain discoveries that other scholars had not found was really exciting for me. Even the most recent one I came to involved an unusual case where in the text Cun Deyi, Honor, Virtue, and Propriety, where the tops of where strips themselves had been incorrectly pieced together, but only given a single excavation number, and so everybody overlooked the possibility that the two strip halves may have been incorrectly pieced together, because if you look at the photographs, there really is a gap in between these. You can tell that the strips were broken. And finding that once you switch the top of a couple of strip halves, the text makes perfect sense. Those kinds of discoveries are really exciting for me.
If you mind, before we move on, and we'll come back to this general question, since you mentioned the Cun Deyi, this is one of the texts that you mention later on in the two volumes, that's actually one of the most understudied texts in the whole corpus, right? So can you, just for listeners, explain a little bit about what kind of text is this, and what is this, so that they can understand the inherent interest, perhaps, of this kind of text for you, and that's related to this discovery of the order of the text himself?
Okay, well, this particular text, in many ways, it's kind of a typical Confucian text, that it talks about the relationship between self-cultivation and the education of the populace, the role of the ruler, and the roles of, particularly of ritual and music in educating the populace and achieving an orderly and harmonious society. It stresses in particular this idea of a human way, a way that is particular, unique to humans, as opposed to, you know, the horses have their way, that the way of water has its way, and everything has a way that's proper to it. And that's no less true of humans, and that takes the form, again, of ritual and music and education through means of sort of virtue and moral suasion, as it were. So that's the kind of the emphasis of the text. But the text is unique in terms of being a text that is rhymed through many of its sections, very loose rhyme. It's very unique in that regard in terms of the way that certain sections are rhymed. And there's only one other Gordian text, aside from the Laozi, that has this much rhyme, that one being Yutong 4. So it's interesting from a number of regards. There's also some quotations that other texts ascribe to Confucius that are not ascribed in this text, but are simply brought in as part of the text. So it's interesting for a number of reasons, but it's also the most one of the most complicated texts in terms of sorting out the strip order for, and for I think for that reason it's been kind of understudied in relation to some of the other texts in the corpus.
So let's actually, and I'm going to come back to wanting to hear about some of the other discoveries that you made in this process that were particularly exciting, so we're going to get to that in a moment, but to kind of build on our discussion of this particular text, some of the things that you mentioned that characterize the nature of the kinds of issues that come up in this zundeyi, or honoring virtue and propriety, are issues that also come up in some of the other texts. And this actually really nicely brings us to one of the questions that I wanted to ask you relating to one of the kinds of phenomena you talk about in the introductory matter of the volumes. So you talk in the introductory matter to the transcriptions and translation themselves about the Guodian corpus as a corpus, right? And there's some things that are common enough across the texts that are included in the Guodian corpus that make it feel like a coherent corpus. And then again, at the same time, there are aspects of this text as a collection that resist a simple classification as a corpus. So can you talk about that a little bit? What, for listeners who are interested in this as a coherent group, what are some of the things that make this a coherent corpus, and what are some of the things that we need to keep in mind that would lead us to resist that kind of a classification?
Okay, well, I think the main reason why we can, I mean, this is a fundamental question that we need to ask to begin with when we're trying to analyze the text as a group at all. Is there any basis for doing that? Because simply because they're found together in the same tomb doesn't mean that they necessarily share anything in common with one another. Just like, you know, some we may have a random collection of books in our own library or in our own study that in some ways maybe show our common interest, that, but are each written by different authors per se. But with the Guodian text, not all of them, obviously, but the certain core group does seem to have some very particular overlaps that are somewhat beyond coincidence. And so I would say, in terms of certain shared language and specific phrases that you see between some of these texts, you know, beyond core philosophical ideas that seem to be shared, but the specific phrases in themselves are what really stands out to make us think that these texts may have shared a common origin in terms of their sort of intellectual lineage that produced them.
And you actually, just to pick up on, again, something that you just mentioned, there were, beside the fact that there were some shared philosophical concepts and philosophical doctrines in some of the texts, the shared phrases indicate that some of them hang together. To push on this a little bit, and then we can come back to what makes these incoherent, perhaps, as a group. You mentioned in the introductory matter or in this discussion of the importance of the text and the nature of the text early in the volume that there are four of these shared philosophical doctrines in particular that we see fairly consistently throughout the text. So heaven and human endowment, paths to virtuous cultivation, education, moral suasion, and the role of tradition, and finally musical harmony and the symphony of virtues. Now, these kinds of shared philosophical concerns are also philosophical concerns that are shared with some of the other material that's not in the Gordian corpus that makes these texts relevant and important to a much wider scholarly field of early Chinese studies. Are there particular texts in the corpus and particular texts that you translated that you find are especially important in terms of the wider scholarly field of early Chinese studies that change or transform or add a really important special contribution to that wider scholarly field surrounding the history of Chinese philosophy?
Sure. Yeah, I would say that in general, so these texts in many ways are like any other Confucian texts of the period. Those four areas that you just mentioned are typical of sort of any Confucian text from the Warring State, and in particular, some of the texts that have been associated, rightly or not, with Zisi and that whole tradition, texts like the Zhongyong, things like that. But what is interesting about these texts is that I think you can see how later debates are sort of incipient, or they're pointing towards later debates over things like human nature. What exactly is human nature? Is it good? Is it bad? The kind of the Mencius Shinza debate that you'll see later on. But you can also see in these texts that is never addressed explicitly. You can see different ways texts like Xing Shu and Wu Xing, right? Xing's Ming Shu, the heaven derives via mandate, or Wuxing, the five conducts, are pointing to that kind of problem in different ways, but never really get there. So it's these from that aspect, they're useful to try and understand sort of the prehistory of that debate, because we really don't have reliable text from the period between before Mencius came onto the scene. And it seems most likely that these texts did predate Mencius by a few years anyway. How far back, we don't really know. But there's also some texts that are more startling. Tang Yu Zhidao, The Way of Tang and Yu, for example, and that this is a text that really extols the ideal of abdication. And we really don't see any other text in the received tradition that extol that idea. They were kind of lost to us in the tradition. And if you look at the way later Confucian texts would treat that concept, it's very much a negative or a problem to be explained away. Why is it that Yao ceded the empire to Xun? Did he really do that? Is that a model that we're supposed to follow in the current age? And you see Mencius trying to tiptoe around that problem. Xun's very vehemently going against that idea of abdication. And so this gives us a text that we really don't see anything reflected in the received tradition, and gives us a whole new set of problems to think about and try and understand the historical context for.
Now, you just mentioned this text, the Xingzi Mingchu, the human nature comes via mandate text, being particularly interesting. And you write in the book about the fact that this text has already attracted a great deal of attention. And I'd actually love to hear a little bit more about your thoughts on it, specifically because you did mention earlier on in our conversation that you came to Chinese studies initially out of an interest in music, right? And this is one of the texts that speaks particularly to the prominence of the role of music and the importance of the role of music in human education. So could you talk about that a little bit for us?
Yeah, sure. It's so music is important in early Confucian thought for a number of reasons. There are a number of different aspects to that idea, right? So this notion of yue, which is also the same term as le, happiness, kind of a combination of both the sense of music and happiness, is often used as a metaphor in early Confucian thought as this representative of the highest state of attainment that one might aspire to. And you see that reflected in the Analects of Confucius. You see that reflected in a text like Wuxing, where, you know, someone who hears the way and finds happiness in it or musicality in it is one who is fond of virtuosity. It's kind of the conclusion of the text. It stated this idea that once one has fully embodied virtue within himself and is able to express that spontaneously in everything that the person does, is one who has attained this ultimate state that is very much like a state of musical cultivation. And you can, having performed instruments yourself, you probably have a good sense of how when you master a piece of music, how that kind of feeling of a spontaneously flowing performance could represent that kind of ultimate state of attainment. And for Confucian thinkers is very much this idea of ultimate virtuous attainment that representing a similar state. So I guess the second sense of music, as it appears in these texts or in Confucian thought more generally, is that the fact that music is thought to have stemmed from our affections authentically. When we create music, we're really reaching deep down within. It also has this miraculous ability to turn around and incite the hearts and minds of others directly and immediately. And so from that standpoint, it was viewed along with ritual as a sort of complementary aspect to ritual as the sort of the supreme tools of education for educating the populace and bringing them into a state of order and uniformity and not uniformity, it's order and harmony. And so Xing Zemingxu has statements like, you know, music has for long occupied the rhythm of our affections. Its return to goodness and recollection of beginning is conscientious, and its bringing forth of affections and the stillment of propriety moves in accord with human nature. This is how it brings order to virtue. And statements like this, talking about how music really has this very direct and immediate impact on us in ways that you would see, precede what you would find in the streams of some very similar ideas about why music is the supreme educational tool. And finally, I think this idea that music in itself is achieved by means of a harmonious balance of disparate constituent parts, right? You have this combination of different instruments, of different timbres, different tones, all operating in harmonious tandem with each other, in accord with a unifying rhythm. And this is the way that society should work. There are different roles to be played by each member, but they are all to work together in a harmonious unity. Yeah, these ideas are expressed in both Xing Zemingxu and Wuxing, and they in ways that both echo and precede further debates on this in the Warring States.
Great, thank you. And just along these lines, just because I'm curious, since music is not just a focus of this particular text, but you do mention that it comes up elsewhere in the corpus, and since you've already mentioned your interest early on in music and music studies, do you still play any instruments?
I do.
What do you play?
I play guitar. And we actually have a band that I've we sort of assembled post tenure, that's one of the things that I like to do outside of scholarship. We have a band called the Funk Upstairs. Awesome. So I'll give a shout out to them. Hi, John, Wes, and Eric. I still do that. So it's an important part of my life, and for the reasons that the Gordian text mentioned.
Great. I'm a banjo player myself, so.
All right.
I'm a big fan. Did you find at all, and then we'll get back to the specificities of the corpus itself, but because, again, early on, we kind of mentioned that the study of language and the study of music are somewhat inherently related. I think for those of us who do both, and even just conceptually, and music is such an important part of what's going on in this corpus, do you find at all that your work as a musician impacted or shaped in any way your work on these texts and your work as a translator or as an interpreter of these documents?
Well, I think so. I think, for one, I guess my interpretation of how the role music plays in these texts, for one, my understanding of what how music works and how it's put together and all that directly in that way, but also in a lot of intangible ways that are very hard for me to describe. Just the way that I've go about analyzing a piece of music, whether it's a classical piece of music or doing a jazz transcription, and trying to figure out what's going on there, shapes, I think, the way I go about the process of understanding these texts, but in a way that's very intangible and hard for me to describe. But I think it shapes my whole analytic way of thinking about things.
Mm-hmm. Great. That's totally fascinating to me. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
So we've talked a little bit about some of the texts in particular, and we've talked about some of the things that link the texts together as a kind of coherent body, or at least as an arguably having some kind of coherence. Aside from the fact that, the fact that they were all, as you mentioned, in the same tomb doesn't necessarily make them hang together as any kind of a coherent unit, are there other elements of the Gordian texts as a group of texts that actively work against our considering them to be part of some kind of coherent group or coherent corpus? Is there anything that undermines basically the sense of coherence that we should bring to understanding these as a group?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, and I would not say that all the texts should be considered as part of the same group. The Laozi texts, for one, offer philosophy that's very much different from what we're calling the Confucian texts of the corpus, and really would be really hard to reconcile with them as part of the same philosophy. So there, I think it's obvious that we cannot consider the entire group as a coherent group, and I wouldn't want to even say with the texts that are in many ways coherent group. They are also individual texts. They each speak to their own set of ideas. So where they may very well have sort of a generally common intellectual stem from a common intellectual lineage, they may also have different individual authors. So I don't want to stress too much the commonality, but the commonality is definitely worth noting. And there are certain uncanny degrees of overlap with very idiosyncratic language that makes us have to speak to them to some degree in terms of the commonality. But there's the differences are equally worth emphasizing.
You just mentioned the Laozi texts. These are the first texts that actually are featured in the series of translations and just transcriptions, and you include Laozi A, B, and C. You mention here that this is an extraordinarily important aspect of the Guodian corpus. So can you talk about the importance of the Laozi text specifically for a little bit?
Right. So they're important because they're the only Warring States period Laozi text that we have, but it's also very problematic in terms of what exactly are they, because it's and we have three different texts together constitute about 40% of the received Laozi or Dao De Jing, and so the question is, what do we have here? Are these sort of materials that were kind of floating around and would later be combined together along with other materials to form the Dao De Jing as we now know it, which some scholars, that's a theory that some scholars ascribe to, or is it more in the nature of, are these selections from a more or less intact, or perhaps let's say partially, or a precursor to the Laozi that we now have, are these selections therefrom? which is it's the model that I would lean toward primarily because it would be an amazing coincidence that all of these the sections from all of the passages from these three texts would happen to make their way into the received Laozi is too much of a coincidence for me to accept. Now, of course, you could say that, well, the Taiyi Shengshui materials were originally most likely bundled together with the materials, the passages in Laozi Si. And you could say, well, look, see, these are not part of the Laozi, and that undermines my argument. But the fact that, well, for one, those materials are concentrated within Laozi Si, and they're structurally very different from the passages that we find in Laozi Si, that there's a lot of argument to saying that the Taiyi Shengshui materials can be grouped together as their own, as a separate text of sorts. But in any case, everything from Laozi A and Laozi B is found in the received Tao Te Ching. So I'm more inclined to the model. Again, it's a question that we can't really resolve at this point, but I'm more inclined to the model that these are selections taken from a larger work that more resembles what we find in the received Laozi, and taken for some particular purpose that we don't really know, and reassembled into these three different texts along with the Taiyi Shengshui materials.
Now, the Taiyi Shengshui materials, this is actually the text that comes right after in your transcription and translation, the Laozi texts. And do you want to speak a little bit to that text? Because it's actually super fascinating from the perspective of the history of cosmology and the history of water.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the Taiyi Shengshui, the great unity gives birth to water. It's a text that, again, it's bundled together with the passages of Laozi Si. And it's a text that seems to be divided into two halves, or can be divided fairly easily into two halves, the first of which presents this cosmology, starting out with the idea that Taiyi, or the great unity, gives birth to water, which in turn gives birth to I forget the exact order, but yin and yang, the four seasons, et cetera, et cetera. It goes on through this process of generation. So you get to the four seasons, and the four seasons circulate, and they're kind of the year is produced, and the cycle goes onward, and water is, in a sense, also stored in and mobilized in the four seasons. So it's a unique cosmology from the standpoint of the role that water plays in it. We really don't find anything quite like it in the received tradition.
So we've talked a little bit about a number of the different individual texts, and we can get back to some of them in a bit, depending on the time we have. But I want to, for a moment, and thank you for explaining a little bit about the Great Unity Gives Birth to Water text, because I think this is, just kind of incidentally as a verbal footnote, this is one of many, many, many examples in this collection of texts that are potentially of really wide and deep interest, even to scholars who, you know, in fact, may not primarily work on China, but are interested in the histories of cosmology, histories of water, histories of other elements that, elements, no pun intended, right, that a lot of these texts actually engage. And the fact that you've given us here a translation into English makes them accessible in a completely new way for scholars who may not have a facility with Chinese. But you do have quite a facility with Chinese, and you've talked about at least one of the cases in which you discovered something about the text when we were talking about this. I think the Zundayi text, the text honoring virtue and propriety, that was particularly exciting. Were there any other moments that stand out for you that were involved in the process of your transcription and translation that were moments of discovery for you that particularly excited you?
I'm not sure what I could point to specifically, but there are cases where I would say that I was able to necessarily interpret many graphs themselves in terms of the actual reading a graph in terms of its modern equivalent, the way that the Chinese paleographers have, but in terms of actually reading those graphs once that they are interpreted and coming up with new readings for certain graphs in context, I think there's a few places where I thought, you know, I've probably come up with a reading that makes more sense than anything else I've found at that point. There's a few places like that that are very satisfying when you come up with at least a strong possibility that this is the reading that should occur within that context. So there are those instances, but again, I think the issues of the strip order are for me have been the most satisfying because of finding a couple, you know, some places where I think there is actually absolutely no ambiguity in terms of once you make those changes in strip order, the many problems are solved. So those have probably been the most rewarding aspects for me in terms of making discoveries.
Now, before we come to a close and I let you go, I can't let you go without asking you about the kinds of texts in here that you refer to as, quote, without doubt, the most enigmatic works in the entire Guodian corpus, because I am a sucker for enigmas. I love enigmas. And this is a really, really fascinating part of these two volumes. And I'm talking specifically about the Yuzhong text, the Thicket of Sayings text. And for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to see the volumes, you include four different Thicket of Sayings text in here, 1, 2, 3, 4. Mm-hmm. The fourth one you have briefly indicated before is notable because it was rhymed. It was one of the rhymed texts in the corpus. Right. The other three as well are really interesting. So can you speak a little bit to these texts? What makes them the most enigmatic works in the corpus, and what is particularly exciting and interesting about them for you?
I would say the primarily enigmatic, well, first of all, because they're very brief, they're brief aphorisms, and there's not much context in terms of being able to figure out what exactly they are referring to. Some of them are fairly straightforward, but many of them not so, and even, you know, recurring characters that in certain instances, the lack of context makes it impossible to determine exactly how this character is to be read. And part of that lack of context for Yuzhong 1 through 3 stems from the fact that these strips are not contiguously written. In other words, one passage may occupy two strips or strip and a half. And once that passage is done, the next passage starts at the beginning of the next strip. So finding out the internal order between these individual passages is very difficult, but also between one strip and the next, because there are many sort of parallel statements, and trying to figure out which strip goes with which is really thorny in these Yuzhong texts. So from that standpoint, they're just the problems of interpretation are boundless, and just the nature of them themselves are as these really sort of pithy aphorisms that may reflect some ideas found elsewhere in the text, but really need further context to understand, make them very, very enigmatic.
Great. Thank you. Now, we've talked about, before we move to the close and I let you go, we've talked about, again, a number of the texts that are translated and collected in the volume. We've talked about a lot of elements of the process. Are there any other specific texts that are included in this volume that we haven't had a chance to talk about, but that you are particularly excited by and that you'd like to mention for listeners who may not know anything about these texts or who may, but may not realize that these texts are, or this, well, one or two specific texts are particularly interesting for you?
Well, there's other texts like Lu Mugong, Duk Mu of Lu asks Zisi, which a very short text, but which is very interesting in terms of the way that it offers this ideal of very frank admonition that one should consistently mention his ruler's faults, for instance. Other texts such as The Way of Loyalty and Trust that speak different ways to this, maybe the changing role of ruler-minister relations in early China. So I think those texts are very interesting from that standpoint. Also, Liu Da, The Six Virtues, which seems to place very clear priority of family loyalty over loyalty to the state in a way that is not quite emphasized to that degree in other texts from the period. So those are all very interesting from different standpoints. And again, the Thicket of Sayings number four, Yu Tong four, is a particular favorite of mine because it's different from the other three Yu Tong texts in that it doesn't really seem to refer to other texts of the corpus per se, and it's also written contiguously, so it's a little bit easier to figure out the order of the text. But essentially, because it has it consists of almost folksy adages and bits of wisdom and a kind of a hodgepodge of things. But it's rhymed throughout, and so there's some very memorable lines throughout the text. And so I think anybody who wants to come take a look at these texts, at maybe one place to one of the more entertaining texts to start with. You have and there's one passage in particular that has a parallel in the received corpus, and that was with the Zhuangzi. Is this one about, you know, this famous line about those who steal belt hooks are executed, while those who steal states are made feudal lords, for instance. Right. And another passage or two along those lines. Other bits of wisdom, like, you know, if a mountain has no foothills, it will collapse. If a city wall has no thatch, it will collapse. If a scholar errant has no friends, he will not pass, and things like that. So very interesting bits of wisdom found throughout that text as well. So it altogether, you really have a whole variety of things in the Guodian text. Again, you have this core of text, Confucian text, that seem to adhere together in certain ways, in interesting ways, but you also have these other variety of texts that present a somewhat different picture. So I think the Guodian texts are very rich from that standpoint and will continue to occupy scholars' attention for years to come. And that's really the goal of this study, is to make that more accessible to other scholars and who might not be able to wade through this vast amount of materials that's out there, and try and make it more manageable for people to actually utilize these texts and try and see how they might fit into the intellectual historical picture of early China or in philosophy more generally.
Great. And there's also, it's not just for scholars too, right? It's also for teachers. So there's a whole, I'll mention for listeners, after this collection of detailed transcriptions and translations and very amply footnoted translations of these texts, there's also a section at the end of the second volume that's a running translation of the text, which makes it actually really fluid and really wonderfully accessible to assign to undergraduate students as well in an undergraduate classroom. And so I think that's another really fabulous aspect of the volumes.
Yeah, we wanted to make sure that running translation was in there, so that precisely for that reason, undergraduates or other interested parties could use that without all the scholarly apparatus, and then may have something that they could, a section of the text that they could utilize without having to purchase the entire work.
So Scott, I've taken up a lot of your time, but I'm happy to have done so in this case, because it's such an extraordinary accomplishment and it's such an extraordinarily important resource. And as we've talked about, not just for scholars, but certainly for scholars, but also for teachers and for just interested readers. And so I'm really delighted that we've had the chance to talk about this. Now, of course, we talked about various aspects of the volumes, but there's a ton of material in here that we didn't have a chance to get to. Is there anything in particular about the volumes, about the process, about the work itself that we didn't have a chance to talk about, but that you'd like to mention for listeners, and perhaps in particular for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to consult the text?
Well, no, the only thing I would add is that, again, this not all the problems have been solved. Nor will they ever all be solved. There's this process of as more texts are being discovered, more manuscripts are being unearthed, I'm sure some of these interpretations will change. So I want to stress that aspect that while I think the work represents the state of knowledge of these texts as we have and presents a pretty coherent picture of these texts, there are still some number of problems that have to be worked out. And I think our understanding of these texts will continue to evolve. But in the meantime, I hope that the people that are interested may read through the book and or those parts of the book that interest them. And I'm looking forward to getting more feedback on it in the future.
So now that the volumes are out, again, congratulations on the volumes. What's next for you? Are there any projects right now that are currently inspiring you?
Well, the first thing was to take a break.
Yeah.
Which. but I continue to work on excavated texts, the materials from the Shanghai Museum and from the Tsinghua collection. I won't get into what those are, but other than to say that those are texts from the same region that have been subsequently discovered, but are not archaeologically excavated. They were robbed from tombs and later sold. So in many ways, they're not as valuable as the Guadian text from that standpoint, but still very rich in what they have to offer. So I'm continuing to work on the excavated text, but I also have a project on that I started for a while and have continuing now and then as time permits, is this study of alcohol in early China, drinking in early China, which is I think an interesting topic that may in some ways parallel the work I've done on music in early China before. So that's an interesting topic for me, and I'm going to continue to work on that as time permits.
Fabulous. And so when that's out, I will be in your email inbox again and asking you to talk about that, because that sounds like another really, really great project.
All right. Looking forward to it.
Thanks so much, Scott. It's really been a pleasure. And I'm really delighted again that you have made the time to talk. So thank you.
Well, thanks, Carl. The pleasure's all mine.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll look forward to seeing you next time.